Hello, my name is Bob Bamber and welcome to the Wrestling 20 Years Ago podcast. We're going back in the time machine to April of 1994. I'm being joined by Craig Wilson. Craig, good to have you back.
Hello.
We'll start with the news, and Craig, I think you're up first.
Yeah, indeed. The Rosemont Horizon in Chicago, Illinois was the venue this month for WCW Spring Stampede 1994. The show was headlined by Ric Flair putting a goal on the line against his old nemesis, Ricky Steamboat. The Nasty Boys continued their feud with Max Payne and Cactus Jack, and the Great Muta flew into the US to face US champion Steve Austin.
Shane Douglas is the ECW Heavyweight Champion. He won the title at a live event at the end of March, defeating Terry Funk after suffocating him with a paper bag and then pinning him. The match was an 8-man cage match dubbed as Ultimate Jeopardy, between Douglas, the Public Enemy, and Mr. Hughes against Funk, the Road Warrior, and the team of Taz and Kevin Sullivan. There were 6 different stipulations based on who took the pinfall, and it was said that Funk would lose his title if he was pinned, and Douglas would have to have his head shaved if he was pinned. Douglas, in the TV tapings, has split from his manager, Sherry Martel, who was signed with WCW.
Sticking with WCW signing news, the immortal Hulk Hogan has reportedly agreed to deal with the company. Hogan has been appearing on WCW TV in recent weeks for interview segments from the set of Thunder in Paradise. It was rumoured that he would debut at Spring Stampede, but that didn't occur, and it is now expected that he'll appear at Bash at the Beach. It is worth noting, however, that the WWF have the right to match any offer that the WCW make for him.
Razor Ramon, not in reality yet, but it has been taped, has lost his Intercontinental title. A match taped earlier this month will air at some point in May on WWF Superstars. Ramon lost his title to Diesel. In other title change news, Men on a Mission won and then lost the WWF tag team titles on the WrestleMania Revenge Tour in the UK. As things stand, the Quebecers are now the 3-time tag team champions, having won and lost and then won the tag titles to Marty Jannetty and the 1-2-3 Kid back in January also.
Jesse Ventura has won his lawsuit against WWF. When negotiating his contract with the company in 1987, Ventura waived his rights to royalties on videotape sales when he was falsely told that only feature performers received such royalties. However, in 1991, he discovered that other non-feature performers received such royalties and brought an action for fraud, misappropriation of publicity rights, and quantum merit in Minnesota State Court against Titan Sports. That has now been settled, and Ventura is receiving upwards of $800,000 from his former employees.
WCW and ECW have reached a limited temporary cross-promotional agreement, which became apparent on ECW television at the end of this month as both Bobby Eaton and Arn Anderson interfered during the main event of Terry Funk vs. Sabu. The agreement was put in place because WCW wants to use the Philadelphia-based promotion to help push Slamboree, which is being held in the city next month. Adverts for the show will run on ECW TV, and Terry Funk will talk up his match against Tully Blanchard on ECW TV also. One of the masked men who accompanied Sabu and Paulie Dangerously to the ring was Bobby Eaton, who attacked Funk and then later Todd Gordon. Arn Anderson came out and ran the pair off. Sherry Martel has signed with WCW, but this is unrelated.
Both members of the former WCW Tag Champions, the Hollywood Blondes, have signed new deals with WCW. The company and fans will be delighted that Steve Austin and Brian Pillman, two of the best up-and-coming stars, have signalled their intent to remain with the company for the foreseeable future. Meanwhile, Charles Bernard Skaggs, better known to fans as Too Cold Scorpio, has been released. It is not yet known where his next destination will be, with Japan being the obvious next step. However, he may be tempted by Philadelphia upstarts Eastern Championship Wrestling.
And finally, the WWF Titan steroid trial, which was initially stated to take place in May, has actually been pushed back to July. No official reason has been given for the delay, but apparently it isn't much of a surprise. We will start the show with a review of Spring Stampede. I'll read the results now. We start the show with Aaron Neville singing the Star Spangled Banner. We then had Johnny B. Badd defeating Diamond Dallas Page. WCW television champion Lord Steven Regal fought Brian Pillman to a time limit draw in 15 minutes. No surprise there. The Nasty Boys defeated Cactus Jack and Max Payne in a Chicago street fight. That was one for the ages. We will come to that in a minute. Steve Austin with Colonel Robert Parker defeated the Great Muta by disqualification to retain the United States Heavyweight Championship after Muta was disqualified for throwing Austin over the top rope. Sting defeated Rick Rude to win the WCW International World Heavyweight Championship. Sting pinned Rude after Harley Race accidentally hit Rude with a chair when he was aiming for Sting. Bunkhouse Buck with Conor Parker defeated Dustin Rhodes in a bunkhouse match. Vader with Harley Race defeated The Boss. The Boss subsequently stripped of the Boss name. We'll come to that in a minute. And WCW World Heavyweight Champion Ric Flair and Ricky Steamboat fought to a draw in 32 minutes after the match ended in a double pin. The title has subsequently on WCW TV been held up, but I'll come to that bit in the TV review. Craig, your thoughts on this show?
It's quite possibly the best WCW pay-per-view under the WCW name, and certainly the best event that we've covered in our discussions for this project. I really enjoyed this. I mean, as you'd expect, there are plenty of a couple of matches here that you could say wouldn't even be worthy of being on television, and I'm talking about the opening DDP match against Johnny B. Badd. But by and large, there was some really good stuff on here. I was going to say I'm slightly concerned by the creeping back in of dusty finishes.
Yeah, we'll come to it in turn. I thought this was a great show. I mean, it's amazing when I go back to Battle Bowl, which was November, and to think that was quite possibly three of the most boring hours of wrestling I've ever seen, and yet by and large, the same group of guys is capable of putting on this kind of show. Top to bottom, this is one of the best wrestling shows I've ever seen. In terms of, you know, alright, it didn't reach quite the peaks that WrestleMania did last month. We didn't get the Bret Owen classic, although we got pretty close with Steamboat and Flair. And we we certainly didn't get close to the Shawn and Razor match, but the tag match between the Nasties and Max Payne and Cactus Jack in its own way was kind of up in that level as well. We didn't quite meet those peaks, but as a 3-hour wrestling show, there was nothing bad on this card. Even a couple of things that I've got notes on and slight kind of downers on, they were good.
Mm.
They weren't as good as everything else on the card. That was really it. I thought it was a great show top to bottom. We will start with Johnny Badd, defeating Diamond Dallas Page. 5 minutes. As an opener, this was quite flat, but I must say that this and the entire show benefited from just an incredibly hot crowd.
Yeah, I'd agree. Although, I have to say that probably the most memorable part of this match was the protracted discussion between Schiavone and Bobby the Brain over whether the move Page hit was a gut buster or a stomach buster. But it was fine. Page is still very green, and Bad is, well, bad.
I mean, how has Diamond Dallas Page got a valet as attractive as the woman who accompanies him to the ring? Because he is 38 years old, I believe, which is incredibly old when you think about it, given that he's starting out. Not particularly attractive, I wouldn't say. With hair like that, I certainly wouldn't say. And yet he walks out with an incredibly attractive woman. I can't be the only person that he's slightly miffed by this development.
Not at all. He must have a reasonably good contract from the company.
That's true. Perhaps. This was quite a flat match. As you say, there was the kind of back and forth between the announcers. This got really good in the last kind of 45 seconds. Johnny Badd, I think he did a plancha to the outside. He then did his punch to DDP, and then did his float over sunset flip from the top rope. Really good finish. Again, 5 minutes, but as an opener, this was better than any WCW opener I've ever seen, and it didn't need to be any better than this.
No, you're probably right. You don't expect necessarily a classic encounter to open up a card.
And then we had a interview, because Jesse Ventura was at the show, and apparently he got there not knowing that he wasn't actually doing announcing, because I read earlier this month that they were planning on doing a 3-man commentary booth going forward. No, they haven't done that yet. But Mean Gene Oakland says, "How are you feeling, Jesse?" And he says, and I quote, "I feel like $1 million, which was a not so well veiled, reference to his rather sizable, financial windfall from the WWF, as we spoke about in the news. We will move on to the television championship match, Lawson Regal versus Brian Pillman. Craig, is it possible that had Brian Pillman not re-signed, Regal would have beaten him clean here? It was just the fact that Pillman had, within the last few weeks, signed a new contract that, well, we can't beat him given he's still going to be around. And so we kind of fell back on this Regal staple, which is the time limit draw. And dare I say what I said 2 to 3 months ago, these are starting to get old.
Yeah, without question. In my scribblings for this one, I'd written another Regal match, another draw. But yeah, no, you're absolutely right. I think Regal would have certainly went over clean on this one if Pillman hadn't signed a new deal with the company. It's probably fair to say also that Pillman's in real danger of being lost in the shuffle here, despite signing a new contract. Going into this one, no one really thought he would win, and it's no surprise that he didn't, but he's not really been on the best of form since the breakup of the Hollywood Blondes.
No, I mean, is it fair to say that, well, not that WCW has always approached their booking in the time we've been doing this show is kind of with a ton of logic, that if you're planning on Pillman leaving in the last few months, you maybe won't promote him that hard, and then he resigns and then you think, okay, we've got to reboot him.
Time will tell, certainly.
Yeah, no, I would say that your point very well may be true in 3 months, but I don't think we can say that yet. But no, this match was fine. I mean, Regal is very good technical wrestler, we know that. There was a lovely spot in the middle of the match where I think he grapevined Pillman's leg, did a roll through into an STF, which was just kind of wow. Watch that back a number of times. It was a solid match. Again, you know, I mean, it was, the crowd got into it at the end with the Pillman race, and I guess that there is the one thing you can say about this is that the longer you do the time limit draws, the more the crowd are going to pop when the guy wins it with 5 seconds to go.
Yes,
that's the one benefit, is that you're laying a series of seeds that eventually will pay off.
They're certainly building to that without question.
But I think it's got to be sooner rather than later, hasn't it? I mean, you
don't want another 6 months of that same finish.
No, because you've got the problem that the crowd, you're educating the crowd that a Regal match is going to start, let's sit back. Now, fortunately for a crowd that was this hot, they didn't do a ton of that, but even so, I think if you're going to be in front of quite a crowd, you might really, like, bore them.
You could be like, oh, we've got at least 10 minutes before this gets good, I'll go and get the beers. You don't want everyone automatically reaching that assumption in a Regal match.
No. But that was fine. Then we had an interview with Colonel Robert Parker and Bunkhouse Buck, and then we go to this tag match. Wow. This was Cactus Jack and Max Payne versus the Nasty Boys in a quote-unquote Chicago street fight. Craig, I don't believe at any point this ever really got in the ring. It was a brawl up and down the entranceway and into the first ever gimmicked merchandise stand, which was cordoned off because, you know, we've got a table and we've got to put someone through it. It was a cordoned off gimmick area. This was an incredible match. 8 minutes. There was a shovel. There was a pool cue. There were two tables put through. There was one point where I think Sags picked up Cactus Jack to pile drive into the table, and the table just gave way. This was a brutal match.
Absolutely. Could probably have went a little bit longer, but it's probably best for the long-term health for all involved that it was brought to an end when it was. But yeah, no, this was a great brawl. You had everything you'd expect. You had brawling, stiff offence, and weapons galore. And it did look very different to the sort of tag team wrestling that you would expect around this time. Absolutely. But and Cactus Jack went from looking a bit like a crazy mid-carder to looking like the real deal here. So that's probably the upshot of this one.
Well, particularly when, now that he's got no right ear, which we covered in last month's show.
Yes.
He was wrestling, because he hasn't had surgery on that yet. He was wrestling just with it bandaged up. And if he didn't look deranged already, you know, with missing teeth at the front, long hair, a bit out of shape, with the massive bandage and just the flat on the right side of his face, just fantastic. If I had to criticise this match, and this certainly isn't, you know, a fault to any of them in it, it was quite difficult to follow. In terms of, because it was all four guys wrestling at once, it wasn't a tag match really by any stretch. It was quite difficult to really kind of follow what was going on, and certain spots weren't picked up, and it's quite difficult to even blame WCW directorially for missing some of it. But it's very difficult to tell what's going on. Lack of psychology, perhaps. But still, this was just so brutal. It was incredible.
Yes, no, absolutely. It was a very fitting end, having Sags using a shovel of all things to end the match.
Yeah, Yeah, no, completely. And yeah, the Nasty Boys retained their tag team championships. Ironically enough, using a shovel, one of their more clean tag team retentions. But we'll ignore that. We had a backstage promo with Johnny B. Badd, who said he wanted to become the US champion. Speaking of the US championship, we had next up Steve Austin with Colonel Robert Parker defeating Muta. Craig, if I was disappointed by anything on this show, it was this match. It wasn't necessarily bad. It was just the crowd were a bit flat, although I guess maybe you could say they would just need to calm down after what came before it. But I didn't like the way they tried to portray Muta as a face in the match. It almost felt like, well, this kind of feels like it might work in Japan, but it didn't work over here. Particularly when they started with the announcement that Muta wanted to arrive and take the US Championship back with him to Japan, which didn't feel to me like a great way to get someone over as a babyface in a US Championship match.
No, I'd give you that. My overall impression of this match was that Muta didn't seem terribly interested by it and was almost phoning it in. On paper, this sounded like it would be amazing, and I just figured it would be Muta, the more established guy, helping to get Austin even further over, but I don't know, it just seemed a bit flat, and I don't think it was necessarily just the crowd, although that wouldn't have helped, but I thought there was something missing here.
And dare I say this match was about 4 or 5 minutes too long? It went about 16 minutes and it felt it at times. Got hot towards the end, but in the middle, it kind of plateaued a bit.
Yeah, and it had that silly finish that American promotions like, the sort of foreigner doing something that breaks the rules, try to make it out like foreign person didn't know the rules. It just seemed a bit of a silly finish.
The finish was, Muta got disqualified for throwing Austin over the top rope. What? Like, I don't know. I mean, but is that a rule somewhere? Am I missing something here? Is that a rule in Japan they just forgot to tell us about?
Of course, the NWA had the rule about throwing it over the top. I just assumed it was Muta used to being able to throw people over the top rope. WCW has a rule that you're not allowed to do that. Cue disqualification and foreign talent looking a bit miffed. But you're right, maybe that WCW rule isn't in place anymore. Well, either way,
well, no, it wasn't, because it happened in the very next match and nothing was done about it.
Lack of consistency and wrestling, shocker.
Just a bit. But no, as I say, like, this wasn't a bad match. It was, you opened a can. This wasn't a bad match. It was just a bit flat. The crowd were a bit flat. And maybe it needed to be this. Maybe, you know, I mean, I didn't rate it down. It was just kind of, it did the job it needed to do, but I felt this could have been more. And that's,
yeah, on paper, I was excited about this and came away from it feeling a bit disappointed.
So anyway, Sting and Rick Rude come out for their match. I'm just checking if I haven't missed anything. No, I don't believe we have. Sting and Rick Rude came out for their match. And then Harley Race comes out and says, whoever wins this match, Vader wants. So whoever leads to the title, Vader wants next. Which is kind of ironic, given that Vader's actually going to be feuding with the loser of this. But yeah, so Sting, I think, attacks Rude, and then he attacks Harley Race. Harley Race, at his age, takes an incredible bump over the top rope. And that wasn't the over the top rope I was referring to about 60 seconds ago. Flies over the top rope to the canvas on the outside. Then Sting throws Rick Rude over the top rope. No disqualification. Decent match. Crowd were really into this, which is just a staple for Sting, who is just really over. There was a ref bump. Race and Vader came out. This got a bit hokey, as it almost felt like Race ended up in the wrong place when he went to hit Rude with a chair. Well, he went to hit Sting with a chair, I believe. Sting ducks. Rude got hit with a fairly soft-looking chair shot. But Sting made the pin. I don't actually think he did any moves after that, which is a little un-babyface-like. But Sting got the pin, new International Heavyweight Championship, crowd popped, good match, crowd made it even better, I would say.
Yep, and Rude against Sting was always going to be pretty exciting, so you can entirely understand why the crowd would be as excited as they were, particularly with Sting being on the ascendancy as he is. I thought the early stuff in this was pretty good, and the ref bump was quite obvious. When the ref took the bump and Sting had the match won with the Scorpion Deathlock. But no, I enjoyed this. Like you pointed out, the finish was a little bit silly, with Reyes clearly missing his cue and Rude having to wait what seemed like an eternity for the, like you say, very weak chair shot that cost him the match and the title.
Could Reyes not find the chair? Was that what caused the delay?
I don't know. It was just pretty awkward. It was Drew having to sort of buy time.
Stall, but, yeah, pretty much.
Yeah.
Well, then we go on to next. We have the bunkhouse match, which I don't know what a bunkhouse match was meant to be, but basically it just seems to be like a match with no rules. Which after my rant on last month's show about a ladder match with no rules, but the main rule being that to win the match you have to grab the titles from on top of the ladder, I quite appreciated this. But yeah, this was Dustin Rhodes against Bunkhouse Buck. Bunkhouse Buck is a character who debuted about 4 weeks before the show on WCW TV. This was a really good match. It was just, it started off quite nice, and then very quickly it got in just kind of rhythm of this is going to be a brawl. I almost wonder whether this was smart having this kind of match on the same show as the tag match that appeared about 45 minutes to an hour before it. Because in the same way, there's a lot of weaponry, although this was more kind of, there was some powder in this match. There was some belt shots. And then there was a glove, a loaded glove, and the announcers kind of blew that finish as well. But this was a really good match. Dare I say the wrong guy won? I mean, I don't know whether, maybe you could say, well, if they're going to continue the feud, maybe Rose shouldn't win out the gate. But I kind of figured that this was a brawl that Rose really should have come out on top of.
Well, it's called a bunkhouse match, so you'd always imagine someone called Bunkhouse Buck would be the favourite for it. But yeah, no, it did seem a little bit strange having him in it. You look at Dustin Rhodes and you think he's one of the guys that could be a big, big player for WCW in years to come. But you never know where this one's going to go. But it did have everything that you'd expect. I referred to Brawl Bingo. So you had Dustin bleeding, check, loaded glove, check, manager throws client a pair of knuckle dusters, check, with the only real surprise being that Dustin didn't intercept him and pick up the win. I enjoyed it. I thought it was okay.
Oh no, I thought it was better though. Okay, I thought it was good, very good. But I mean, it was a very odd finish because, kind of Robert Parker hands Bunkhouse Buck a glove. And the announcers go, oh, the glove's loaded. Which makes sense. Bunkhouse Buck gets in the ring, punches Dustin Rhodes, goes to the cover, and Dustin Rhodes kicks out.
Yeah.
And then Bunkhouse Buck goes to the outside. He then gets handed a pair of brass knuckles and then hits Dustin Rhodes, and that ends the match. And it almost felt like the announcers called the spot in the wrong place. But it was a very odd thing that you get handed the glove and then you get handed the brass knuckles. Sure, don't do both.
Yes, No, it did seem a little bit funny, but oh well.
Yeah, no, fair enough. But no, another really good brawl. I can't say any more than that. And if they're gonna like do it next month, Sam Marie, why not do something similar? We cut to the back. Jesse Ventura getting word with Rick Rude. Rude is not happy, saying he didn't need any help to win the title. Vader overhears Rude, and then they have a brawl backstage. Wrestlers breaking up, including one quite hilarious moment where a Brian Knobbs wrapped in a towel is trying to break up the fight. But we will talk about the logistics of Rude feuding with Vader after the end of the review, so we won't cover that now. Vader against the Boss. This was two super heavyweights brawling. I love this.
Same. This is the sort of match I really like. Two big, very able superstars in what was always going to be quite a stiff slugfest. At this point, Vader is probably the best big man in the world of wrestling, right?
Oh, by a mile.
And a couple of years previously, you could probably have said the same about the Boss, and he's still got a lot of talent. And I mean, we knew we were never going to get too many drop toe holds here, but we did get a flying body press and a Vader sock to end it. But you knew that this was going to be a pretty hard hitting affair, and I like this sort of stuff. I like both of these guys, so this was a big win for me.
No, I completely agree. I love heavyweight wrestling. I love just two guys who look like, well, he's big and he's big and let's see what happens. I mean, occasionally you can get kind of, but this wasn't, this wasn't a big man match in the way that, say, Undertaker and Giant Gonzalez was. This was just two, this was two heavyweights. They weren't big guys. They're both very athletic for their size.
Yep.
There's one point spilled to the outside. Boss whipped Vader into the guardrail. Vader flipped into the front row. That was quite good. There's another spot later on where Vader goes for a run and ends up flying over the top rope, which is good. No DQ, but we've covered that. Bobby Heenan, who almost in kind of vain, just said, why do we even bother with a ring at one point during this match? which was quite good. Vader was on the top rope and Boss did a lovely body slam to him to the middle of the ring for a two count. And then Vader won, a power slam, Vader bomb, moonsault. Excellent. I loved it. I do it again. Like, I'd watch this a million times though. It was great.
Yeah, no, I could watch this again right now. I really liked it.
And then after the match, this didn't really make sense, but when we fill in the details of why it was done, I think you can kind of understand it. Race goes to handcuff the boss, but the boss takes out his nightstick and just starts beating up Race, which I kind of thought, well, it's not really the biggest babyface mood. But they kind of break it up, and Nick Bockwinkle tells the boss to stop. They go backstage, and the boss is being interviewed by Mean Gene Okerlund. Nick Bockwinkle comes back and basically says, you're abusing your powers. He strips him of the handcuff, strips him of the nightstick, and says you are no longer the boss. Now, the backstory behind all this is that WWF have basically been in touch with WCW and said, yeah, can you quit using our gimmick? And so this was WCW's way of basically writing off the gimmick that Ray Traylor, was the boss's real name, is using. A little bit ironic given that Ric Flair came into the WWF as the NWA heavyweight champion, but we'll ignore that bit. But Craig, what do you think of this? We'll discuss kind of in a bit more detail after when we do the TV stuff. But it was a little bit contrived in the sense that why would the boss get so angry at Race? I guess he lost because he's a babyface. But I thought, given what they were trying to achieve and given that they had to try and find some logical way of basically stripping away his gimmick entirely, it kind of was good.
Yeah, but you'd sort of hope that a law enforcement officer would have a better understanding of the law.
There's that. There's that.
No. You're right, it did seem just a bit sort of kind of obvious. You're like, oh really, but I mean, if they can get him something else good, then that's fine. But I do absolutely take your point in the fact that they had Flair debut with a pixelated title and talking about him being the real world champion and everything like that. But I guess when you're in a battle, all is fair in love and war.
Something like that. And then we move to the main event. Ric Flair and Ricky Steamboat fought through a draw in, in 32 minutes. Steamboat had a double underhook chicken wing submission locked in on Flair, who was kind of lifted up. He then kind of fell back in like a German suplex style motion, with a bridge, although the important point being there was no bridge. And so they both end up with their shoulders on the mat. Nick Patrick looks, goes, well, you're both in pinning positions, counts at three count, and basically ended as a draw. But it should be said, in the 31, not that was necessarily that bad, although we can talk about the finish in a minute, the 31 and a half minutes prior were really good. Like, really good. Nothing kind of, you know, a lot of comparisons being made to their 89 match. You know, they are both 5 years older now. But really good back and forth action, both quite even. This was excellent.
Yep, like you say, you mentioned their 80s stuff, and it doesn't sort of compare to the sort of Broadway classics that they had throughout the 80s. But like you say, these are guys 5 years older, and they've adapted that style and still been able to tell a great story 5 years on. These are like two really, really good top guys. These are sort of like the pinnacle. And you put two guys in the ring, and other than their historic issues that they had, there wasn't really much to this build-up. But you put two really great guys in the ring, get them to tell a story, and they tell a great story. And there were some great subtleties from Flair in this one that's sort of indicating a soon to be heel turn. And as we mentioned earlier on, Hogan's just about to debut and they're having their world champion turning heel. I wonder what's going to happen.
Well, true. I mean, as we kind of said last month on the show, his heel turn has kind of already started. Nothing especially kind of easy to pinpoint, in the sense that it wasn't necessarily one event, although it was kind of when Steamboat accidentally hit him in mid-March on Saturday night. But yeah, they kind of slow burned it, and I think if you didn't see that, you might just think it's Flair dialing it up a bit. But yeah, I think they're going to start to make him a bit more obvious of a heel going forward as we get to Hogan. My only question was, as it transpires, as they've kind of written into WCW Saturday Night, they're not going to do the rematch at Slamboree. They're going to do it on TV. To which I kind of thought, well, if you're not going to sell another pay-per-view on this, why not just have Flair pin Steamboat? Surely you need Flair as strong as possible going up against Hogan.
Yes, if it's not leading to a pay-per-view payoff, then you may as well have Flair going over and looking awesome as a heel champion ahead of the debut of the biggest face in wrestling history. No, you're absolutely right. It does seem such a stupid way to build up a match for WCW Saturday Night or whatever. Strange, but
yeah,
we've not got the book. Maybe things would be a bit. It would be simpler times if we had the book.
Just a bit. I was going to do it in the TV review, but I'll do it here now just to kind of wrap up the story. In the episode that followed, or the first one certainly they taped after the show, basically Nick Bonkinger will say, well, we haven't quite come to a formal decision on what happened. And then Flair and Steamboat got into a confrontation. I believe what happened was Flair basically said to Steamboat, okay, you want the title, you can have it, i.e. if you want me to give it to you, do it, take it. To which Steamboat said no. And then I believe because of those actions, Nick Bonkinger said, right, okay, well, we're going to have the title is upheld. Ric Flair is not the WCW heavyweight champion at the time of recording. There is no champion, it's vacant. So they're going to decide that in 2 weeks. I mean, again, maybe they're just going to try and pop a rating with it on TV, which, sort of fair enough. But I still would have said, look, it's again, they're not doing Flair and Steamboat at Slamboree, which is a little bit strange. And I would have thought, wouldn't that be the perfect place for a rematch and then set the ball rolling for Hogan? That would have been my approach to it. But still, no. Craig, to wrap this show up, fantastic. I mean, we have individual problems with certain points, but again, I don't believe a perfect wrestling show exists, but this was pretty damn close.
You're right, a perfect wrestling show doesn't exist. You need a match to sort of calm the crowd down, to build it back up to a crescendo. You need a match here and there where it gives guys and girls a chance to go and grab a beer, go to the toilet, things like that. But you're right, this is... Since the beginning of what we're doing, this has been the best show, without question. Nothing comes close. This is the best.
Completely agree. Completely agree. Your score rating, Craig?
I missed last month. Are we doing it at 10 or is it at 5? I forget.
Is that a rib on Colin doing the same thing 2 months ago? It is out of 10.
I would say this. 8 out of 10. I'd have given it a 9 had it not been for the double pin in the main event.
See, I've given, I believe, 2 shows since we started this project 9s. And maybe on reflection, giving Starrcade a 9 was a bit high. Although the main event of that was excellent. It was kind of... Everything else was being propped up by that main event. I'm going to give it a 9.5. Again, the half point was probably just the screw finish of the main event. Otherwise, where's your fault in all this? I don't really have one. There was the odd thing, it was like, nah. But at the end of it, it was a great 3 hours of wrestling. And we've been sat doing this project for 8 months. I think we've done 6 or 7 WCW pay-per-views now. What really annoys me is that this roster is pretty much unchanged from the roster that was there when we started, barring Sid Vicious and David Boy Smith at the top end of the card.
Uh-huh.
And they had this show in them. And I sat through Battle Bowl, which was the same bunch of guys. It was the same bunch of guys. It was a wrestling ring. It was a 3-hour show. Battle Bowl was awful. This was great. I almost don't get it. I almost don't know how you're capable of producing something so good. I don't know why I get so angry at something so great. but yeah, 9.5 for me. It was excellent. And I highly recommend, if you've got 3 hours of your day, go back and watch this.
Without question.
Craig, we'll kind of do what we did last night with WWF and kind of have a look at the kind of state of the top end of the WCW roster. We'll start with Ric Flair, and admittedly we discussed some of this at least during the Spring Stampede review, but on the way to becoming a full-fledged heel, I wouldn't say he's there yet, although they kind of started the turn about a month, 5-6 weeks ago. What do you think about Flair right now? You know, he won the championship against Vader at Starrcade, big win. Since then, you know, he had the kind of screwy-ish retention at Super Brawl in February. We then had the retention here, which was kind of the double pin. Now, Mitley's turning heel. We've got the stuff with Hogan coming up, and I think him being heel is logical, because I think you want to be... You know, I said before about my worry about whether Hogan might end up getting booed by the WCW crowd. And I don't think you want to be in a position where you do a kind of Hogan and Warrior, where it's two good guys and we'll see what happens and hope for the best. I think you want to be a bit more explicit, just so... anyone on the fence is going to be pro-Hogan, which is what you want. But I think that this was the match that he kind of needed to win clean, and I think he needs a big win at Slamboree next month, because when you're going to go into that match, we assume, or we believe it's going to be in July at Bash at the Beach. We believe it's going to be then. So if that's the case, I think Flair's in a very good spot at the top of the card. Interesting to see what happens when Hogan comes along, though.
I agree. I have to say though, I mean, it's always been sort of, up until this point, I'm a WCW guy, I'm a WWF guy, and even a heel Flair, I still think the bulk of the crowd would still be behind Flair over a face Hogan, simply because Flair's their guy. But that's probably a completely separate point. I think, like I said in the piece about Spring Stampede, I really enjoyed a lot of the subtleties of Flair stuff. And you've been talking about how the heel turn has been building, but it looked really good against Steamboat, especially when you compare him to the face in peril that he was against Vader back at the tail end of last year. I think Flair's just such a big game player for them. And it's only right that he's the first guy that we talk about in this roster review. He's the WCW top guy, and at this point there can be no other guy that Hogan could feud with when he eventually makes his debut. It's just going to be interesting to see what reaction he gets from the WCW faithful.
Yeah, I mean, we don't know if anything's changed, but as it stands, Flair isn't the champion. I don't know whether Sid wins it back or not. I mean, it's on TV, so we'll know probably sooner rather than later, because it won't be live. It would be an odd one if the plan was to take the title off Flair, not to do it at Spring Stampede. So I suspect one way or another Flair goes into the match with Hogan as champion. Is there anything to be said, maybe, that Hogan could be... You could almost... Don't do Flair and Hogan first up. Is there a beneficial thing to maybe say, give the title to Steamboat. Steamboat is the transitional champion that drops it to Hogan. And then you can have those two on a collision course, or maybe Starrcade at the end of the year. Is that maybe a better idea?
No, I mean, Steamboat's a guy that's been a face all his life. And the transitional thing, obviously, when you talk about Hogan, you've got the sort of Backlund dropping it to Sheik, who dropped it to Hogan some 10 years ago. But even in this situation, no, you need it to be a heel that Hogan comes in and faces, and you need it to be a strong heel. And whilst I have to admit, The one that would most excite me, and I guess it's a guy we're going to come to in a bit, would be Vader versus Hogan. I think that heel champ Flair, and I imagine he's going to get the title back quite soon against Hogan, is probably their best bet.
Yeah, it's not to disagree with that. It's just more whether, is it their best bet in 6 months' time or 8 months' time, rather than Hogan's first match in? Or is it just a case of Hogan's so big, to match him up against anyone but Flair would be a huge disservice to Hogan up front?
Yes, I think it would be. There really is no one else that would be on the same be on the same page. And it's going to be kind of weird because let's be honest. We know when Hogan comes in, Flair's going to be spending the last few seconds of their match looking up at the ceiling. And it's just where Hogan goes next. The very idea that Flair will retain against the debuting Hulk Hogan is almost farcical. So yeah. It's where he goes next. And you know what? I'd pay to see a program with Vader, but I don't know if Hogan would want a program with Vader, but that would be the logical next step. But I can't at all look past Flair versus Hogan in the summer.
No, I think you're right, and I agree. It would be mental to bring Hogan in against Flair first up on the money you're paying Hogan, apparently, and not have Hogan win.
Just be kicking the legs from under him.
Yeah, I just wonder whether it's more a case of have Hogan come in. Because, I mean, is there a point to be said that you might... Not everyone know of Hogan, but not everyone who watches WCW will have seen a ton of him. That's kind of where I'm wondering whether, if you built it for 6 months, kept them apart, you know, you've got two world championships, so maybe that's the unification match if you want to do it. I'm just wondering whether there might be a bit more benefit to having that car crash at Starrcade where you can build Hogan up a bit. And particularly as Hogan's not wrestled in 12 months. Not that he's necessarily a great worker, and plus no. Flair can get a great match out of pretty much anybody.
Yeah, but he could wrestle lumber him.
Yeah, he could. But I just wonder more whether it might just be worth saying, let's build to this match. Because this is an epic match. Okay, it was a match that WWF had the opportunity to do and chose not to, probably because it didn't do all that well in terms of house shows, etc., etc.
That's the bit I'm interested in. I mean, if it didn't work for the WWF on the house show circuit, and boy, did they trial it with big main events at Madison Square Garden and everything, how's it going to be different the other way around? It's going to go from a WWF crowd not taking to Ric Flair to the risk of a WCW crowd not taking to Hulk Hogan. It's just been flipped. I don't know how necessarily you can really look at this and see it as a banker.
And dare I say, it's far more risky that a WCW crowd wouldn't take to a face Hogan than it would be for a WWF crowd not to take to a Flair.
God, yes, absolutely.
I mean, because if the WWF crowd doesn't take to Flair a couple of years back, you could just turn him heel. And it just carries on, but
yeah, you refresh him quite easily, absolutely.
And plus, you know, Flair is a guy who can be capable as a heel. We've never seen Hogan as a heel. We may never do so. I mean, there is a lot of risk involved here. We haven't, and maybe we'll leave this discussion for when that match is official in kind of May or June, because it's not going to happen next month. Hogan hasn't. We believe the agreement is in place. There is still the kind of dot the I's, cross the T's, etc., etc. This match isn't taking place at Slamboree. Maybe we'll talk about this in more detail then rather than labouring it now. There's a great deal of risk in this match as well, in terms of, as I say, if they're pro-Flair, what the hell do you do? I mean, I don't know, is the long and short of it, because they're paying Hogan a ton of money on the basis that he's going to draw a lot. I mean, if you commit to it and they don't like Hogan, maybe you have to turn him by definition, but there's no guarantee that's going to draw any money.
Yeah, no, that's it. It's a huge risk, and WCW will clearly have went all out to try and get Hogan to sign this deal. We're talking big bucks. They clearly see Hogan as a game changer. We've talked previously on this podcast about how we thought, specifically me, thought that the Hulk Hogan character was exhausted, and that was around the King of the Ring 93 period. So what's that? What, 7 or 8 months ago? And since then he's not done anything.
Dare I say he's in a slightly better position now than he was 8 months ago because he's been away from TV?
I mean, you could also say that during his run in his WWF champion back in 93, he was away from WWF TV. But yes, no, I do take that point, but it's an enormous risk. It is a gamble. It's a big throw of the dice from WCW. If this works, then the phrase game changer, it's something that you could definitely appropriate to this.
It's the rare use of the phrase game changer that actually could be a game changer.
Mm-hmm.
That would be how I would describe that in full.
This would actually be a game changer, not the hyperbaric normal use of the phrase game changer. Yeah, no, without question, but it's all about how the WCW crowd take to him. If he hits the five moves of doom and covers Flair at Bash in the Beach, are the crowd just going to go tonto? You just don't know. And I mean, that's with every gamble, that's the sort of thing you have to do. But if it works out, then I think it's going to really work out. That's what must be keeping, that's what must have made this decision to put Hogan on a big deal.
So easy, yeah. I think we'll preview that more as and when the time comes, because as I say, it's not happening in the next few weeks. Let's move on to Vader. We've had Vader as world champion throughout 93, lost the title to Flair at Starrcade, lost his rematch at Super Brawl. Is it fair to say he's just kind of now, they're just shuffling him out of the title picture? A feud with the Boss, which I would have been a little underwhelmed by, but I'd say the match this month was great. Moving into a feud with Rick Rude, which is odd, given that they're both heels. But I think it's fair to say that Vader is just in a good spot now where, as you say, he is probably the logical follow-up to Flair once Hogan beats him. So I would expect Vader against Hogan probably by October?
Yep, I think... certainly by the end of 1994, we'll have seen Vader and Hogan lock up without question. And I think he's certainly in the position of being there or thereabouts at the moment. Obviously, he needs there to be a face champion. So as long as Flair, in his new heel position, retains the title, and we're already talking about the end of that, then Vader's out of the picture, title picture. But after that, then... it seems a logical next step for the WCW.
I think what's exciting is that you can... in my head, I feel like I can put Vader against anyone and make a really good feud.
Yes.
Because he is big, so like he has his limitations, but he's so good at what he does. He could have a great match with someone like the Boss, who's just massive. And yet, you put him with a guy like Flair, he can have a great match with him. I feel like I can put him with a guy like Steamboat, and he can have a great match with him. And it just feels like an endless number of options. Ironically, one of the guys I wouldn't apply that to would probably be Rick Rude. Perplexing on that. I mean, we can transition into Rude while we do it, but odd, given that they're both heels, and I don't particularly want to see either of them turn face.
No, and my immediate thoughts from Rude's match at Spring Stampede was the sort of deterioration, if you will, in him generally. He didn't look like the same sort of guy that had been wrestling in the WCW months prior, nor did he look the sort of guy 4 or 5 years previous was in the sort of main event picture in WWF. He just doesn't... Broken's perhaps harsh, but he's verging on breaking down. So the very notion of him being sort of any sort of a main event player going forward is unlikely.
Yeah, I think he's still an asset to you. I mean,
yes.
I love the character. I think he's great. But yeah, I'm yet to, in this project, I'm yet to see a great Rick Rude match. And that would be, I think he's the kind of guy that, yeah, I can put him in a position where he's going to do some money with us, but I don't think I want to put him right near the top because I think that'd be a mistake. Again though, I think he's the kind of guy that, even if his in-ring work isn't great, he can more than carry. The feud with Sting was really good. It was quite basic. It was kind of paint-by-numbers type stuff. But it was a perfectly fine feud. He's a great foil for somebody like Sting as well. And so Rudy's a great talker. And again, there's a lot of pairings that I'd like to see Rude maybe transition into a feud with someone like Pillman or like Dustin Rhodes, where you've got Pillman and maybe isn't a great talker, Dustin Rhodes and maybe isn't a great talker. You can put those elements together. And I think he'd get a very good match out of both of them.
Yes.
And that would kind of be the role I'd prefer to see him in going forward. And then occasionally maybe, if you've got an odd pay-per-view on the side, you can push him into a match against Hogan. Hogan beats him and he goes back to the mid-card. That'd be kind of where I'd want Rick Rude going forward.
Yeah, if Rude did get a title shot, you wouldn't think it was totally out of place, no. But a prolonged period at the top of the card, you'd be like, what's he done to deserve this? But yes, no, I take your point, absolutely.
Ricky Steamboat. I mean, this was the exception. Not in terms of him being a great wrestler by any stretch, but this kind of placement on the card really has been the exception for Steamboat. And you get the sense that up until this last month, he's just kind of been the guy that has been... He's a good worker, getting on a bit, but can still go. We can put him in a pay-per-view undercard match and he can carry the load. Almost feels like now he's just kind of... I don't know, really. I don't know where you're going next.
Yeah, it is a little bit strange. There's no sort of obvious thing. I mean, the Buster talked about him versus Flair not having any sort of obvious build-up. It seemed to work from its historic perspective, but no, you're right. Just... There's no sort of obvious next place for that super babyface Steamboat character to go. I think that sort of whilst it's ironic that we're talking about a super babyface like Hogan coming in, I think the sort of time, the sort of length that the character of that like that can go is coming to an end. I don't think a sort of super babyface really has that much of a shelf life these days. Which yeah. It's slightly ironic, all things considered, but the next step for Steamboat's not terribly obvious, despite his very, very obvious talents in the ring.
Well, I mean, I guess he could win the world title in a couple of weeks. That should be said. I don't think he will.
Yes, yeah.
It'd be a very sideward step if he did that. But yeah, I'd almost put him as the babyface Rick Rude. In terms of, he's the older guy, okay, in many ways they're completely different in the sense that Steamboat is great in kind of his work and Rude is great in terms of his talking. But, you know, as much as I talk about Rude working with Pillman and Rhodes, put Steamboat with Austin. That kind of seems to me the perfect step if we're going to talk, we're going to talk about those guys in a bit, in terms of let's utilise Steamboat while we can still get a great match out of him. And again, maybe you could transition into Hogan and Steamboat at some point, but I don't think you would. You've got the option that if you need a quick fix in a top match, he could be your guy. But if not, let's have him hovering just below that and working with some of the other guys on the card. I think if you need a quick fix in the main event, this was it. This was the match. And so I think, yeah, just transition him back in, keep him there, prominent. He's a veteran on the card, he's over with the crowd, still a very big use for you, but I think it's a case of let's drop him a couple of levels and then we'll keep him flying at that level.
Yep, I'd agree wholeheartedly with that. He's handy to hover around.
Yes, completely.
So I'm just going to say he's handy to hover around.
Yes. Sting, what do you think?
Oh, the only way is up for Sting. You can see that, just the sort of crowd reaction. He's at the sort of... There's a good 6 or 7 years left in Sting as a top main guy. So, yeah, the WCW are right to transition him into a sort of proper main event guy. The fact he's now the international champion, whatever that title actually is, can only mean good things for him going forward. He deserves a run with the gold. He deserves a bit near the top. See if he can transition from a sort of upper mid-card to a main eventer. The signs all look like they can, so now's the chance for him to step up.
No, I completely agree. I mean, Sting is one of those guys where he's really more over than his talents really warrant, to a degree, in that he's a good talker, but no better. He's a good wrestler, but no better. And yet behind Flair, he's the most popular guy on the card. And in some places, he seems to be getting a bigger reaction than Flair. Now, okay, Flair's a heel now, or he will become one would think. And Hogan comes in, he probably stays in the number two role as well. But he is a guy that is a massive asset. And I like the fact they're giving him the international title because it feels like, okay, we don't want to put it with Hogan. We don't want to compromise that. So give him the international title. And okay, it's not as big as the world title, but it kind of floats not that far below it. And we can just put him on his own path. And it's the sort of thing where I think I keep the international title on him for, I don't know, 18 months, 2 years. and then see where that is, and then maybe when Hogan's not champion anymore, and maybe when he is, you could either do a face versus face match, or you could transition one of them into a heel, and then create that kind of big blow-off match. I think he's in a great spot.
Yes, I agree.
Let's talk about the boss. Well, not the boss anymore. We'll cover the specifics in a minute.
The artist formerly known as the boss.
Yeah, well, in fact, I better do this bit now. I'll pull this bit from the WCW TV review, which we're going to do in a minute. The boss is no longer the boss after we spoke about WCW. He was switching his baton, his garb, and the name by Nick Bonkwinkle after the legal dispute with the WWF. Yeah. He was briefly on WCW Saturday Night as Ray Traylor, which is his real name. But he will now be known, going forward, Craig, as the Guardian Angel, having been met by two other quote-unquote members of the Guardian Angel Club, whatever they were. He was given a jacket with Guardian Angel on the back, and that's going to be his character going forward. I suspect, long story short, not a ton changes in terms of he's the babyface enforcer and he's the quote-unquote Guardian Angel that helps out the babyface in need and stuff like that. So it kind of makes sense. But yeah, an odd gimmick change in terms of I think there maybe would have been better names for it. I'm not sure trying to get someone over as a big, good badass called the Guardian Angel is necessarily a hugely smart thing to do, but he is in a good spot. He is over to a degree, and he is he is a guy again who is capable of having a great match with someone like Vader.
Yeah, no, I think there's certainly a significant place on any for any promotion having someone with experience of. I guess we'll have to use his real name with him being slightly gimmickless, but yeah. For him, he's going to always serve a purpose. Not to the same extent as we talked previously, how you could transition him into sort of a main event picture necessarily, but he's going to be there. I mean, Vader probably would have had nothing to do had it not been for that, the match putting the boss in against him, and in the end we got quite a good match. So yeah, there's something for him to, it's always going to be a place and a card for him, and he's always been quite close with Hulk Hogan, so we might see more and more of him as the months progress.
No, completely. Let's talk about three names. We'll probably take them as a... Well, there is a group. We'll go through... I'll name them all anyway. We've got Steve Austin, Dustin Rhodes and Brian Pillman, who I would say are the three young members of the WCW roster that they've invested time in that appear on pay-per-views more often than not, because you kind of got that kind of rotating and bubbling undercard guys who seem to change every month. These are three guys that I would pick out from the crowd that are guys that have been on TV more often than not, been on pay-per-views more often than not. We'll start with Austin. I think he's in a good spot. US champion. Singles run. I think he's working quite well with Colonel Robert Parker. I'm yet to see that spark that says to me this is a guy you can push higher up the card to a degree. But no, I think Austin's in a good spot right now, and just kind of keep him with the US Championship, keep him on a path, have him work with someone like Ricky Steamboat, and then see where you are in 6 months' time.
Yep, you're right. There's so much that... There's really nothing for WCW to lose having Austin sort of do a lot of stuff, because if it fails, then they can just be like, oh, well, they gave it a bash, and if it succeeds enormously, they can be like, we were right to go with this. So... No, it's a no-brainer, and him having the US title, good short term. It's where he goes after this.
Yeah, no, I'd agree. What do you think about the pairing with Colonel Robert Parker? I think that's a good one. I'm yet to be blown away by him. I think he's capable of going it alone, but I think the Colonel Robert Parker is more a case of while Austin is still kind of versioning as a singles act, let's put it with someone that the crowd know to dislike, so you can kind of almost reflect that onto him.
Yep, I'd agree wholeheartedly. We don't know for sure that Austin's not very good on the mic or can't cut a promo, but it's certainly going to be beneficial to have him having someone around him that can cut one.
Dustin Rhodes.
I really like him, although there is a sort of bit of by numbers sort of feel to some of his matches, I have to admit. They're quite formulaic, but I like him. There's the obvious fact that he's second generation superstar, so he's got that lineage thing, wrestling's in his blood, he's very talented in the ring, seems quite charismatic, certainly one of the guys that you would think that if you were to fast forward a couple of years, it's probably a bit of a big deal.
Yeah, I mean, I'm yet to be blown away by any of his work, but equally, I'm yet to think, no, this isn't going to work. I think it's more a game that he'd be the guy, of the three names we're talking about, I think he'd be the guy that I want to test the water with. And we were having reports kind of 4 to 5 months ago before Christmas that they were thinking of giving him one of the big major titles. Now, admittedly, there's been a lot going on backstage at WCW since then. And I guess you could say, well, one of those reasons would be that Dusty Rose was a big player now, and as I believe is the case, he's not, although we get conflicting reports on that on a weekly basis. So, I think he's the guy who I'd be... Let's keep him on a path, but equally let's think of... Let's try him out against someone like Rick Rude. Let's see how he can handle a feud against someone like that. And if he passes it, then keep on going. You know, that would be my thing. I think he's got all the tools. I wonder about his charisma at the moment. I think he is a bit of a paint-by-numbers babyface. It is all a bit straight up and down. There's not a lot of edge to him. He is very much a kind of respectable good guy. And there's nothing tremendously wrong with that. But when Hogan's at the top and he's going to be doing something like that as well, I wonder whether you need a fraction more of an edge, something a little bit different that makes you stand out from the crowd, particularly when you've got Sting, who's amazingly popular. I don't think you're going to climb a ton of rungs on the WCW babyface ladder as a generic babyface.
Correct.
I think
times are changing too much for you just to get by on being the sort of...
Lex Luger.
The good-looking babyface that... the fans scream for when you come out. I think you need a little bit more to your character than that. So it'll be interesting to see if Dustin Rhodes can add something more to his character. And he's got everything that should push him towards the top in terms of his in-ring ability, his athleticism, and his look. But he does still just need that a little bit extra. So we'll see what happens.
Brian Pillman.
I like him a lot. And I mentioned him being a bit stuck in a rut since the Hollywood Blondes, and you were earlier on, and you were probably right to mention the fact that there was obviously a little bit of doubt over whether or not he would sign a new deal and stuff. So it was clear until that was resolved that he was never going to be pushed into the main event picture, for example. But he's got a lot of talent in the ring. In fact, a really good talent in the ring. Now that that contract situation has been resolved, it'll be interesting to see where he goes now. Next couple of months are going to be quite big, because I talked about him being lost in the, could potentially being lost in the shuffle. He needs to separate himself from that, but he's got all the attributes that should make him quite a significant player. But like I say, the next couple of months will be key.
I haven't seen enough of Pillman yet to go, yes, this is a guy that I think would work. He's a good in-ring talent, but we haven't seen enough of him as a babyface. I think continue to put him in those spots. Flesh out the character a bit, I think, would be a necessity, given that they don't seem to have done a lot with him since the Hollywood Blonde split, and that was all, 6 months ago. But equally, he's got the talent, I think. He's got that raw talent that could put him in good stead. And yeah, just continue to focus on him and see where you are. You know, it's not like WWF where we talked about last month, where it was almost a case of, God, they've got two or three guys at the top. Beyond that, we're just putting guys in spots that we hope are going to work. WCW are in a great position right now as a roster overall. They've got a real strong top end. And when your issue is maybe we're a bit light on up-and-coming guys, that really isn't that big of a problem versus not having guys at the top. And so I think, again, yeah, I think, Craig, overall, WCW roster just in a great spot, sitting with Hogan coming in?
I think they've got every reason to be cheerful. They've got a lot of younger guys that are coming through that show all the hallmarks of being main event guys. And they've got the right mix of experienced guys. We're talking about people like Steamboat, Flair, and potentially soon Hogan, that have been there and done it. If these younger talents can get the rub off these guys, then... I mean, they've got the world at their feet.
Finally, on the WCW chat, we will move on in a sec. Just quickly, just to wrap up the one paragraph from the TV review I haven't done. A lot happened on WCW TV this month, just that it was all building to the pay-per-view and everything else we've covered. But mainly just so that Hulk Hogan again was a big part of TV this month. featured in a second on-screen interview, I think, since we recorded the show last. He was the third wheel in the Flair Steamboat feud, I think probably to a fault in terms of it was, Flair was being asked five questions, four of them were about Hogan, and I kind of thought, well, okay, bigger picture stuff, and now they signed him. You know, not that that was ever really a risk, I don't think. But I wonder whether they were almost kind of cutting their knees out from under them short term for the benefit of the long term. But yeah, Hogan was on TV a lot, and the other big story was the Boss, and we've covered that. We'll move into the WWF television review, and a lot to report since WrestleMania. Bret Hart cut his first promo as WWF champion, saying that he was a fighting champion and promised Yokozuna a rematch for his championship. Yokozuna, who's interestingly enough now in a feud with Earthquake, which I think it's quite a big step down. Hart also had quite a competitive back and forth match with Quang, who is a new character on WWF television. Jerry Lawler has been all over Raw since he's been back. We've had, I think, the last three Raws have all included in-ring King's Court segments. The first with Lex Luger, who was promoting his feud with Mr. Perfect. Interestingly enough, now that both Luger and Yokozuna are basically just given up on the title, which seems odd. We had women's champion Alundra Blaze, who was out there starting a feud with Luna Vachon, and then Nikolai Volkoff was out there as well with a feud with Lawler, a segment with Lawler as well. Tag team titles have been probably the major in-ring storyline on TV this month. On television, at least, the Quebecers never lost their titles. That Metal on a Mission transition happened within the entirety of the UK tour. But the Quebecers on TV have been feuding with Captain Lou Albano, who's basically been saying, I've got a tag team that can beat you guys. And yeah, he's bringing out the Head Shrinkers, who I believe are going to face them next week on Raw. So we'll have the results of all that on our main review. Shawn Michaels is out of in-ring action, but still very much a part of television. Hosted a segment called Heartbreak Hotel. He's very much still with Diesel. Any thoughts that those two might be splitting up? Very premature. But he hosted a segment called the Heartbreak Hotel, featuring a large love heart bed. A largely just a front for a promo on Razor Ramon, who they're building to the match with Diesel, where Razor will lose his title, which hasn't happened yet. Michaels ended the segment by saying, the Heartbreak Hotel, where you can check out, but you can never leave. And finally, on Raw this week, in a very bizarre segment, we cut to a deli worker who claimed to the Undertaker had walked into his shop, and apparently he likes cheese. Anyway, that will wrap up the WWF TV review for this month, rather. Craig, I've got a few kind of brief discussion points. I know you've not seen a ton of it this month. Why have Razor dropped the belt so soon after beating Shawn Michaels? Okay, Razor was champion going into WrestleMania, so it's not like it was a two, three week reign. But given how great that match was, to hide it away so much with relatively so little build is perplexing to me.
Agreed, but we also from the 94 Rumble, how much faith the WWF clearly have in Diesel. So it's not a terrible surprise that he has been pushed towards a title. But I guess the only real surprise is the way that it has been done. You're right, it does seem a little bit flat considering how amazing the victory was. There's obviously going to be some sort of big boost from having whoever the next champion is have a big win over Razor, and to do it essentially on the QT seems a bit bizarre, but I don't know where the WWF are going to go with this, but they clearly have some high hopes for Diesel.
Yeah, clearly. I mean, I guess you could say that they're protecting Razor in kind of transitioning the belt off him in a quite quiet way. Let's do it on Superstars, or less people are watching, not live. We won't. They built to it. It's been building on Raw for a few weeks, so it's not like they've ignored it, and it's not like they could have done it on an international tour if they'd have really wanted to kind of brush it under the carpet. But still, odd. I mean, is there a positive from this for Razor? Because I guess you could say, well, they're kind of transitioning out of the Intercontinental title level upwards, but upwards is Bret Hart, and that's not a match we need to see right now.
No, the 93 Rumble match wasn't great. Although it was a Razor over a year ago compared to the leaps and bounds he's made. But I don't think there's really any sort of space in the main event picture yet for Razor. I don't think a face versus face thing's the very obvious thing to go, and I'd be a bit worried about sort of short term if I was Razor Ramon, based on the fact that Diesel's won the title.
Yeah, I agree a little bit. I guess we should wait to see it play out. I mean, we don't know exactly how it went down, and I'll add that to my WWF TV review next month when that airs. But still, that was a bit strange. Let's look at Bret Hart. Championship reign so far, a little flat, although I guess we are kind of 5 weeks into a 12-week gap between pay-per-view shows, so they can build that up slowly. I find it slightly perplexing that Owen has done some stuff on the championship, Luger's done barely anything, Yokozuna's done barely anything. It feels strange that you've got three guys who all in some way or another have some form of claim on the championship to one degree or another, and yet they don't really seem to have kind of given any focus yet. Bret Hart's major happening on Raw in the last 4 or 5 weeks was a very close match with Quang.
Yeah, I think the one that the bit that I'm most excited about is the inevitable brother versus brother title match. And I know that was something that came into our mailbag just this very week, in fact, on whether or not Owen was someone that could have a title shot in the near future. And based on the sort of very clever way that WrestleMania 10 was booked, it does seem like the very logical next step, because you not only have you got a guy that had beaten the champion on the very same card that the champion won the belt, but the fact that you had in the family dispute, there's a lot in that story. That's a great story. There's a lot of buying at a very different level. So short term, it seems that Owen Hart's on the ascendancy. Next 6 months might be interesting. Come maybe towards the end of the year, we might see him in the title picture.
No, I agree. I mean, thanks to Chris Lacey who sent that question in. He sent another one in that we'll come to in a second. Is that rematch one and done though? As great as Owen was, and as good as that win was, isn't that just Bret beating Owen? Because I don't think you want to give Owen the championship at any point in the near future unless something dramatic happens in terms of he learns how to talk or they give him a manager or something like that.
No, I agree, but there's also not anyone that sort of jumps out as an obvious alternative.
No, true.
I think one thing's clear in the last couple of months, especially from WrestleMania 10, and I know my thoughts on that are still to come due to missing last month, but it's clear that WWF have just been like, Luger, that didn't work.
This all ties in together, because my next point on my notes, and we'll come to Chris Lacey's question in a minute as well, was what's Jerry Lawler's role going forward? Do you think maybe, given that we never got the payoff to the Lawler-Hart feud, maybe that's a good King of the Ring type match, particularly as it's the King against the former King of the Ring, at King of the Ring, for the championship, the match we never got. Do you think that maybe is a good short-term solution?
Yeah, it's certainly something, although I have to admit, and you mentioned it in your TV review, I quite like Lawler's King's Court? Is that
King's
what
Court
it is?
Segment, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, it's no Piper's Pit, but I think it's quite an entertaining segment to have as part of the TV show. I think that's certainly something that that the WWF could take advantage of. There's no sort of obvious alternative. Beefcake's gone, so Barbershop's not there. There's no longer the Brother Love, so that's gone. There's a sort of platform for an interview segment like that. Piper's Pit was something in the 80s that could lead to significant momentous feuds and stuff and big segments. So it would make sense that they would go to that tried and tested place to try and get something that they could use to get guys working together and stuff. So yeah, no, I would use, as good as Lawler is behind the mic, and whilst I certainly think there is some in-ring value to him, I think I don't necessarily think that having a King's Court front and centre would be a bad idea.
No, I mean, I'll go back to my idea of having Lawler manage Owen Hart, but we've gone through that before, and I don't get the sense it's a route they're necessarily going to go down. And one final thing, the question from Chris Lacey, where do you see The Undertaker going next, Craig? I mean, I pitched my idea on last month's show about having Undertaker run through all dozen of the guys that interfered in his Royal Rumble match, ending with Yokozuna at WrestleMania next year. They very briefly mentioned him on Raw, quite where the whole Delhi thing comes in, I've no idea. But Undertaker's role coming back, because there is a feud with Yokozuna, I guess, off the bat, which you could do. But is it gonna be difficult to keep him away from Bret Hart?
I don't know. I don't know if the Undertaker character's really done anything recently to put himself into the main event picture.
His last match was in the main event of the Royal Rumble.
Yeah, but I mean, still though.
And Survivor Series.
Yes, but I still don't necessarily see him as a title contender. But I mean, we could equally talk about the lack of viable alternatives. So there isn't much to go with. And in terms of the people WWF have currently, that many main eventers, and Undertaker, as you pointed out, is someone that's been in the main event picture. But I don't see it as a very sort of obvious one, but I wouldn't be surprised if they sort of pushed him into that picture. But
yeah, no,
I don't know. Bret Hart, Undertaker, is that really a big deal?
Well, it's the face versus face problem we were talking about earlier with WCW, isn't it? It's kind of, it is,
but I also think that, sorry to cut you off there, but I also think when you talk about your point from last month, I think that The Undertaker short term certainly got a couple more things to do to sort out before he gets to the title picture.
Oh yeah, yeah. I mean, as I said, I mean, I propose getting all 12 and stretching it to WrestleMania. I don't think they'll do that, because that'd be a lot of discipline stuff, and plus, like, of the 12 guys, 2 or 3 aren't regulars with the company, and another 3 or 4 of them are just pretty much jobbers. So it's not necessarily a ton of value in that. There's a money match with Yokozuna, and there's something with Crush. Beyond that, do you want to put Jeff Jarrett against The Undertaker? I don't think you do. Because that's just such a clash of characters in terms of a country music singer and an Undertaker. But no, I think we'll wait and see how this plays out. They mentioned him on Raw, so you almost suspect in the next month to 2 months we'll know more. I think will be long story short. Into the ECW TV review. Shane Douglas won the ECW Heavyweight Championship in an 8-man, quote-unquote, Ultimate Jeopardy cage match in March. He pinned Terry Funk. The match was Douglas, the Public Enemy, and Mr. Hughes versus Punk versus Funk, Taz, Kevin Sullivan, and Road Warrior Hawk. Each had a stipulation on them, and they were as follows. If Douglas was pinned, his head would be shaved bald. If Funk was pinned, he would lose the ECW title. If the Public Enemy lost, they would lose their tag championships, and they would have to leave ECW. If Sullivan and Taz lost, they would have to disband as a tag team. If Road Warrior Hawk lost, he would lose the Road Warrior name. And if Mr. Hughes lost, the babyface team would get 5 minutes alone inside the steel cage with his manager, Jason. That was quite complicated. That was a house show match. It didn't particularly feature on TV. But it did involve the title change, Shane Douglas winning the Heavyweight Championship. Can I say, Craig, and I know you haven't seen almost anything of ECW in the last couple of months, so I won't be having this up to discussion. Shane Douglas's promos right now are up there with anything on television. I stand by that point. I think I'll send you the tape of him, his promo after he won the title. Excellent. Really good. And he's lost Sherry Martel, but I don't think he needs Sherry Martel. Okay, having a valet can help him being a heel, but talking-wise, he's phenomenal. And do I want to compare him to Flair? Probably not. But I put him in and amongst the conversation with Flair, with Lawler. That kind of mix of the best talkers in North America right now. I think his promos are superb. And he's doing really well. Okay, he's relatively new role as champion. Also, the ECW Television Championship has changed hands twice since we've last been with you. Remember, that was the third week in March, not the end of March. Taz lost the championship to JT Smith, and then Smith, a few weeks later, lost it to Pitbull. Also, we've had the heel turn of the Sandman, who is less of a surfer these days. Basically, this has been brewing for a couple of months, so I didn't think it was worth noting last month. The catalyst of all this was Sandman being blinded and striking his valet in his pictures, which is really like life. The story being that Sandman basically believes his friend and best man at his wedding, Tommy Cairo, is having an affair with Miss Peaches, which is where that's going. Craig, briefly on ECW, I mentioned in the news their kind of storyline with, or the kind of their agreement with WCW. And one thing I didn't mention in the TV review, but I mentioned it fully in the news, was the Arn Anderson, Bobby Eaton segment. Apparently there was murmurings that ECW were offered some promotional time on WCW TV, perhaps some kind of an angle. Do you think ECW can get more from this thing beyond presumably some money for some advertising and use of Arn Anderson and Bobby Eaton?
It does. It's something that sort of makes sense for them short term. I mean, fledgling upstart company, I think they need all the help that they can get. WCW, an established name. WCW clearly seeing some sort of benefit to them from the relationship, and I think that's key. I think the idea that it's a two-way thing benefits WCW. Benefits ECW, because if it was just something where WCW like, oh yeah, there's nothing for us to gain from here, but yeah, we're happy to partner up, then there would not necessarily be anything that Eastern Championship Wrestling would benefit from this. But because the WCW see the sort of promotional aspect, etc., then I think they stand to potentially gain a little bit more than, like you say, just having Bob Eaton and Arn Anderson on their show.
Yeah, I mean, I wonder what ECW can gain on WCW TV, given that there's just such a really a kind of like split in terms of what both their styles are. And I don't know what characters you'd send from ECW to make that work. You wouldn't send Sabu, maybe you'd send Shane Douglas, but Shane Douglas works because he's the king of the mountain in ECW. Yeah. I don't think you put Shane Douglas in a mid-card feud with, I don't know, Brian Pillman. I don't think it really works. His whole point is that I'm the franchise of ECW. I'm the number one guy. So you put him with in a mid-level feud with Brian Pillman, which you presume Douglas would lose. I don't think that helps. Funk is already appearing on WCW Slammarie anyway. I think he's facing Tully Blanchard, if I remember that right. So you're already getting that there. So yeah, I think maybe if I'm ECW, maybe I've got what I want to out of this. I'm getting some advertising money from the WCW ad spots. I'm getting Arn Anderson, which is a great coup for them short term. Maybe if I can get a couple more wrestlers out of it, maybe I do. If I can't, it's a good deal short term. I don't think there's a ton long term they can benefit from it, unless it was perhaps more of an organic kind of talent trade type deal where, you know, WCW get some guys that they want to feature on TV, send them down to ECW for a bit of conditioning and develop their character a bit and then send them back up. That could work. But I don't know enough about ECW to know whether they'd like that deal or not. Craig, your moment / match of the month.
It has to be Flair versus Steamboat. Like I said earlier, whilst it didn't compare to the Broadway classics from the 80s, it still showed two guys were able to tell a story, told to tell a story, and they put on a great performance. Let's look beyond the finish, because we discussed that earlier on, but these were two guys, very top of their game, putting on a fantastic, fantastic match. It's got to be either that or the hardcore match, the sort of hardcore tag match, but for me, it's the Flair Steamboat that just edges it.
Yeah, I'll give a very honourable mention to the tag team match, the Nasties and Max Payne and Cactus Jack, which was excellent. But my match of the month was Vader and the Boss. I love that style of wrestling. Just two super heavyweights, have a brawl, clean victory, which, you know, is still at this point very satisfying on a WCW brand that isn't famous for it. And it was just a really, really fun match to watch. For me, it was the most enjoyable match of the show. I'm not necessarily going to say it's going to be the best, but this was a show where There were other months where four or five of these matches could have been match of the month. I firmly believe that. Craig, your brief-ish thoughts on WrestleMania. You weren't here last month, and I kind of wanted to get anything... Well, I mean, you're probably going to end up agreeing with largely what me and Colin said, but anything else on top of that and just your general thoughts?
I was thinking about this today upon reflection, and I have to say I think WrestleMania 10 is the best WrestleMania from the first 10 years of the event. You've got two absolute classic matches in Bret versus Owen, as well as the Razor versus Michaels match, and I have to think that Michaels versus Razor is probably the best WrestleMania Intercontinental title match as well. It's my favourite WrestleMania since the event began. I love the show. Gutted to have missed the podcast because I really could wax lyrical for a lot longer on the strengths, and there were many of this show, but no, I really enjoyed WrestleMania 10.
No, I don't. I would add something, but go back and listen to our last show when me and Colin did about 50 minutes on WrestleMania. Let's go forward and talk about the Ultimate Warrior. A bit more somber, and obviously we're now in 2014 time. The Ultimate Warrior returns at WrestleMania 30, takes his induction into the WWE Hall of Fame on the Raw on Monday, cuts a largely nondescript promo. I thought at the time, I just thought it was kind of generic Warrior promo. A lot of people were trying to read more into it. And then, Craig, me and you wake up, the Britain as the nation wakes up, I guess in a lot of cases in America as well, wake up to the news that Ultimate Warrior is dead. I mean...
I was stunned.
My dad asked me about this. My dad, who couldn't care a lick about wrestling, said... Wasn't there that guy who died as well? Like, that kind of level of notoriety. And just, not that it's the Ultimate Warrior's dead, just that. It's the Ultimate Warrior's dead, who was on Raw like 24 hours beforehand. That is jarring. It's just like that weird to me out thinking about it.
Yeah, no, you're right. I was in like day two of my new job, and I thought I'd just get the cat out of there. I was just like, right, I'll let everyone know that I'm a wrestling fan, and they can mock me for the rest of my duration in this job. And they were just like, wasn't there a significant death last night? It's just one of those stories that it's not just a wrestling story. It's sort of, you saw all the big papers, the Sun over here had a big story on it, the Daily Mail, BBC, all the big sort of UK places that you would go for your news were covering a wrestling story. It just sort of, it's one of those things that transcends the real news, the real life, and the crazy, often over the top world of wrestling. It was it was stunned. I remember I couldn't, because I started my new job the day after WrestleMania, so I couldn't stay up to watch WrestleMania. So instead, I chose to stay up the night before to watch the Hall of Fame. And for me, the Hall of Fame was all about the Warrior. As a kid growing up, and I'm slightly older than all the other contributors so far to this podcast, but when I was a kid, the choice was Hogan or the Warrior. It's like a sort of wrestling twist on the Beatles or the Stones, and I was always transfixed by the sort of bright colours, the speedy entrance, the pounding music of the Warrior compared to the say your prayer and eat your vitamins over the top good guy that was Hogan. So to go from seeing him talk about the proudest moment of his life, not being his wrestling success, but being the father to his two daughters, and seeing him making amends with WWF after years of where the relationship was very fraught, to then him having getting the chance to address Raw after 18 years of not being on the show, to the very next day hearing such a tragedy. It was tragedy is really the only word to describe it. It was just shocking. It's an incredibly sad thing. The fact that you've got a guy that changed wrestling in a way that immeasurable sort of impact he had in such a very short time at the top to go out in the way that he did. Very sad indeed.
I'm glad he got closure. I'm yes. glad that this wasn't 12 months ago and it wasn't Ultimate Warriors died on, you know, we'd heard the story about, you know, the, whatever the DVD was called, the self-destruction of the Ultimate Warrior.
The hatchet job.
Yeah. I mean, I'm glad of all that and fantastic. And I'm glad we got kind of the positive side of the story. I'm glad he made up with the company. I'm glad that there's merchandise out there. I'm glad they did the documentary of him coming back. It does feel a little bit like, as not quite to the same degree, but as much as the self-destruction was a hatchet job, and as much as he makes a very good point that you could do that style of thing on so many guys, mm-hmm. it does feel like the story that we're now being presented is almost too far the other way. It's almost, let's make up for it. Let's try and pretend that by and large everything was good, and it wasn't with the Ultimate Warrior. No. I think you've almost got to kind of take both sides of the story and go, let's be realistic here, it is somewhere in the middle.
Yes.
But his legacy is of a guy who got incredibly hot and then fizzled out very quickly. He's almost, yes. he is almost the WWF version of Goldberg in terms of a guy who just got extremely big, and I don't mean the double meaning of big there, but got extremely hot, got massively over, but it fizzled out very quickly. I mean, it's testimony that his match, which WrestleMania was his match with Hogan? 6 or 7?
6. It was 6.
We're here at WrestleMania 10 in our 20 years ago timeline. It's not that he's not there anymore. He's not been there for about 2 years. And I think that's testimony that he got so big so quickly, but it just didn't last. And okay, we're going to have him resurface in a couple of years with that match against Hulk Hogan at, in 96. God.
In fact, not 98 in WCW, but we've got his WrestleMania 12 against Triple H.
Of course, yeah, that's true. But no, I mean, have you had time to watch the Warrior documentaries on the network yet?
I've got the Warrior new DVD set and I really enjoyed it. Although it's just crazy that 1 week I'm watching him talk about his career and the next it's over, but it's, you watch his matches and although I've obviously talked passionately about how I was a Warrior fan as a kid, there's nothing to his matches in terms of...
Oh God,
of,
I mean...
You watch that and then it's just like... I was going to say, you watch that and there's nothing to it, but here we are talking about his importance to the wrestling world. It's remarkable.
Oh, completely. I mean, I often have the discussion on Twitter and things like that about what wrestlers would work in other eras, either forward or backwards, which would work and which wouldn't. I can guarantee, as nailed on, that the one that the big star that wouldn't work in this era is Ultimate Warrior. He wouldn't have lasted 5 minutes in this era.
No, I mean, it'd be seen as a poorer version of Ryback.
Yeah, I mean, like...
Because at least Ryback's quite funny.
Yeah, and Ryback can, to a degree, wrestle. Like, Warrior was so limited in the ring. And it's testimony to how good the character was that he patched over that and some with his ability, with his charisma and with the character, and to a degree with his promos, although they weren't all that special, they were more just kind of out there. But it is a testament to how good he was that he made so much with so little. And I think that is his legacy. Is there a guy that, because when Warrior said, like, well, on the network show, it wasn't the documentary, it was a show about quote unquote Warrior's greatest matches. Not a very long list. And he basically said there was this myth going around that I didn't have any great matches, but I'm glad to say that this and everything going forward will prove otherwise. I don't think that proved that. You know, you watch some of his matches and they are so incredibly basic. And don't get me wrong, for the time, they worked. And people at the time were saying he was an awful wrestler, so that's not any different. But it worked in the time. It's like Bruno Sammartino might not have worked in today's era because his style of wrestling probably wouldn't have worked. But yes. Warrior, you have to say, for all his faults, and there were a lot, and they've all been well documented, etc., etc., he made so much, and he lived the dream. And I, as I say, I've said a few negative things about him, and I think that's with fair comment, because, and he has passed away. I'm so glad that he got closure in terms of, he got to make up with the company. He's at the point now where the company are going to tell perhaps a story that is maybe a peg or two too positive, but I'd rather it be there than where it was with the Self-Destruction DVD.
Yes, agreed.
And that will end this month's show. Wow, we've gone long. Craig, thank you very much for joining me this month.
It's been a pleasure.
You have a Twitter account, you have a blog, plug away.
Yep, cool. A blog, largely about the oldie days of wrestling. You can find that at ringthedamnbell.wordpress.com. It tends to focus largely on the sort of early 90s, mid 90s period of wrestling, the period where I grew up and was fascinated even more than I am now by the sport entertainment. And you can find the blog on Twitter at twitter.com/ringthedamnbell, but the last L is replaced by the number one.
There we go. It's as contrived as that. You can find me on Twitter at Boy Bama for my modern day wrestling musings, at wrestling20yrs for live tweets and news and other thoughts from the podcast and everything we're doing here. wrestling20years.com for all the other episodes. And I think that's about it. We're back next month. We've got Slamboree. I was planning a massive thing on the steroid trial, but that's now been moved. It does tell you how much I live this project, that up until 3 weeks ago, I was fully under the impression that the steroid trial was in May. And it was only when I read the April news cycle that it's been moved to July. So I don't have to plan that yet, which is good, because that's probably going to have to be a show in itself, separate to what we do on a monthly basis. We've got Slamboree, we've got a lot of other stuff coming up. Yeah, so anyway, until next time, I've been Bob Bamber. This has been the April 1994 episode of the Wrestling 20 Years Ago podcast. And until next time, goodbye.